back on the train. This time tomorrow, by foot, wheel or sail. But this time no sorrow. First stop, Jackson. Next stop, Shangri-La. And I cannot wait to see the expression on the face of my sweet Lord.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Master. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California's System-Wide Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She's also a professor of political science at UC San Diego and served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs with responsibility for China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Mongolia. And in 1993, founded and continues to lead the Northeast Asia Cooperation Dialogue, an unofficial Track 2 forum for discussions of security issues amongst defense and foreign ministry officials and academics from the United States, Japan, China, Russia, and the Koreas. Her latest book, now in paperback, is China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. And she has a forthcoming book, Changing Media, Changing China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan Shirk.
Thank you very much.
And I don't know whether you, the level to which you are masochistic and were watching the recent Republican presidential debate on foreign policy, which was absolutely shockingly replete with gratuitous China bashing. Mm-hmm. But the one exception was the former U.S. ambassador to China, John Huntsman, who actually seemed to say something that I found very interesting, and I suspect it may well be the content or part of the content in your new book, Changing Media, Changing China. He said that China was poised for a huge generational shift and that there's an extraordinary number of young Chinese who are internet savvy, globally oriented, and that when they come to power, things are going to change radically. Would you agree?
Well, I certainly agree that there's an information revolution underway in China and that people have much more knowledge about what's going on in the outside world as well as what's going on in different parts of the country. And the most media savvy part of the population certainly are the urban, well-educated younger generation. And these folks are increasingly frustrated by the limitations on their access to information, which is very transparent as the propaganda department yanks sensitive stories off the internet. And so the hand of the censor is very visible. So on the other hand, the censor is not winning the contest. And despite censorship, people still do have a lot more information than they used to do in the Mao era, for sure.
So would that mean then that the treatment of the artist Ai Weiwei is in fact a kind of litmus test, or at least a yardstick in this to and fro tension between freedom of speech demanded by the young and control demanded by the Communist Party?
Well, I don't know if I'd say that the Ai Weiwei case is a litmus test, because the treatment of a dissident artist is still kind of an issue that is of concern to a relatively small number of people in China. You know, a kind of artistic intellectual elite. I think there are issues such as how openly to discuss the causes of the high-speed rail crash or food and medicine safety or land requisitions, those kinds of issues of justice and of public safety are probably more salient to more people than the Ai Weiwei case.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, who's the was formerly the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs. And President Obama's trip to Australia and then on to Indonesia for the APEC summit is in the wake of Secretary Hillary Clinton's announcement of a so-called pivot towards Asia in terms of the Obama administration's new foreign policy doctrine that appears to promise to look towards Asia and China and away from the traditional primary focus on Europe. Let's begin with Australia. The notion that 2,500 Marines is really upsetting China, deployed in Australia, that really upsets China, with given the size of the People's Liberation Army, seems a little ridiculous to me. How do you relate to that firestorm of criticism?
Well, first of all, the Chinese response actually has been surprisingly mild. If you compare it, you know, kind of calibrated with the intensity of anti-American rhetoric about containment, it really hasn't been all that bad. And I think it's because President Obama very carefully said that this is not aimed at China, that we need a place for our Marines to train. The area in Australia offers that space. We're starting off small with just 250. They'll be rotated in. By the way, this is something that we started talking about in the Clinton administration. So it's been under discussion for quite some time. And when he said this is not aimed at China and that we believe maintaining a U.S. military presence in the region is good for everyone, you know, it may be a bit ingenuous because, of course, the rise of China is part of the context of regional security, but I think it enables the Chinese not to respond with too much rhetorical heat.
I suppose I should have been clear there, Susan Shirk, that most of the criticism was within Australia about whether to take this stance and to alienate Australia's biggest trading partner.
Well, I don't think China is going to stop trading with Australia or treat Australia as an enemy. In fact, to the contrary, I think that China will probably intensify its efforts to engage Australia diplomatically and economically.
So in terms of the subsequent meetings in Indonesia, of course, the President Obama, first of all, he is a child of the Pacific, if you will. He was born in Hawaii and spent a number of years in Indonesia. What was your takeaway from the APEC summit?
Well, we had the APEC summit, of course, and then we also had the East Asian summit. So the president has been very busy this week, spending the entire week in Asia, and it's an opportunity for the Obama administration to roll out a new, very active diplomacy in the region of the sort that we've never seen before, frankly, because typically, it's very hard to get our public officials out to Asia because Washington is so far away. This is the tyranny of distance. We want to be an Asia-Pacific power. We want to maintain our presence in the region militarily as well as diplomatically and economically. But it's often hard to do it, and we find ourselves concentrating on traditional diplomacy in Europe or in the wars against terrorism in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Asia kind of comes in last place. Well, the Obama administration came into office determined to try to remedy this and to show that we are not marginal players in Asia, that we're there to stay despite our current and hopefully temporary economic difficulties. And I must say, it's been quite, my view is that it's been extraordinarily successful.
Well, one of the things that I find extraordinary, Dr. Susan Shirk, is the extent to which the United States and the punditry, both here and in Europe, has this expectation that somehow China is appropriate for China to bail out Europe. And you could make the case that that President Obama's re-election fortunes are in the hands of Angela Merkel, in as much as if the European economy tanks, the fallout will affect our economic recovery, as anemic as it is, and therefore affect the president's fortunes of being re-elected. But the first question would be, why do we expect this poor country, whose average income, I believe, is something like $6,000 a year, to bail out both, not only to finance our deficit, but to bail out the Europeans?
Well, I think probably because they have these massive foreign exchange reserves, and they therefore do have, as a government, the wherewithal to contribute to a package. And also, people think that China will want to increase its influence in the world and therefore will want to contribute. But in fact, China is quite wary of making a contribution that attracts too much attention. If they thought that joining in an international effort such as through the IMF would really be helpful in bolstering the economies in Europe, and of course Europe is China's largest trading partner, so that's pretty important to them, I think they would want to do it. But what they don't want to do is to have a benevolent action of trying to help Europe just feed into perceptions that China is becoming so powerful and therefore that it's a threat.
And what about the notion of the president's vulnerability vis-a-vis Europe? Do you agree with that?
Oh, my goodness. Well, of course, the state of the U.S. economy during this election campaign is one of the most important, if not the important factor in what the outcome will be, and therefore to the extent that our economy is tied to the troubles in Europe, certainly it matters a great deal.
So in your book, China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise, Susan Shirk, you made the case that our continually overstating China's this great juggernaut that is taking over the world. You're saying, well, wait a minute. You know, the Chinese leadership are always looking over their shoulder at the extraordinary changes within the country, the division between the inland and the coast, and now, of course, the disparity in wealth in China is starting to approach the disparity of wealth here in the United States.
No, so it surpassed it, actually.
It has surpassed it. Well, so you know, it is China appears to be in a state of such transition. I don't know. Give us an update on that dynamic, whether the fears of the West are overstated and the internal divisions are growing.
Well, China's leaders are incredibly insecure and nervous about domestic threats to their power. That's been the case, especially since Tiananmen in 1989, when party rule almost ended, in, of course, the same year that the Berlin Wall fell and the communist rule in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe began to disintegrate. So they are very nervous about internal threats, and they continue to be so. Each generation of leadership has less of a personal prestige and following, from Mao to Deng Xiaoping to Jiang Zemin to Hu Jintao and now to Xi Jinping. So, but I think that internal weakness actually is a risk from the standpoint of peace and security of the United States and of China's Asian neighbors, because what could happen is that China's leaders might feel compelled to make verbal threats, even backed up by some military exercises, toward Taiwan or toward Japan or even possibly toward the South China Sea, because domestic nationalism has grown so strong and is stimulated by the media and the internet. So for China's leaders to defend themselves and to maintain their domestic popularity, they may be tempted to make threats that they feel they can't back down from without losing their power at home. And that's one reason I do think it's very important to have a strong U.S. military presence in the region so that when China's leaders are tempted to make those threats, they look out over the water and they see the risks of doing so.
Just in the last minute, or less than a minute, Susan Shirk, the battle, if you will, between the kind of Communist Party of China, which is in many ways resembles a kind of mafia organization, and the emerging government, rule of law kind of agencies that they're trying to create, where does that stand?
Well, unfortunately, political reform has really stalled out. There's been no progress in political reform, and I'd say no progress in economic reform for the past 10 years or more. The court system continues to be under the thumb of the Communist Party. So China's leaders have adopted normatively the ideal of rule of law, but they certainly haven't realized it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Susan Shirk.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan Shirk, who's the director of the University of California System-Wide Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She's also a professor of political science at UC San Diego and served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs with responsibility for China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Mongolia. And in 1993, founded and continues to lead the Northeast Asia Cooperation Dialogue, an unofficial Track 2 forum for discussions on security issues amongst defense and foreign ministry officials and academics from the United States, Japan, China, Russia, and the Koreas. Her latest book now in paperback is China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. And she has a forthcoming book, Changing Media, Changing China. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with the former congressman, now head of Common Cause, Bob Edgar, talking about the super committee deadlocking and the extent to which the whole thing has been kind of kabuki theater. The super committee came about because of the economic hostage crisis, where the Republicans essentially threatened to destroy the good faith and credit of the United States government if they didn't get their way. And as a compromise, they came up with this idea of seven members from both sides coming up with a deal with a gun to their head. If they didn't reach $1.2 trillion in cuts, the trigger would be pulled and we'd have automatic cuts. Well, guess what? They haven't agreed. They're not going to agree. And the trigger won't happen because they've got about a year to weasel their way out of it. Bob Edgar also talked about the Stock Act story, about how the Congress is free to do insider trading. And they're all making a lot of them are making a ton of money on the stock exchange. Whether the outrage over the 60 Minutes piece will provoke and will force them to look at the Stock Act, he thought that that was a possibility. But again, he felt that the real issue was getting rid of Citizens United. I spoke with Asla Bali after that. She's a specialist on Turkey. And we talked about Turkey's growing and assertive role in the Middle East and how much they're pushing for the end of the Assad regime in Syria and how valuable and important they'll be in stabilizing a post-Assad Syria. A lot of interesting inside information about the Turkish leader and about the relations with Israel. And then finally, I spoke with Susan Shirk, the former Assistant Secretary of State in charge of Asia and Chinese affairs. We talked about President Obama's trip to Australia and to the APEC summit. Her basic point is that the Chinese leadership's real focus is on internal matters. They're looking over their shoulder, hoping the whole place doesn't fall apart, while we think of them as this great unstoppable juggernaut. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
time.